Hey, Slingers, welcome back to another week of the Word Slinger podcast. Now, is social media BS? Now, today's guest thinks so, and he's going to talk about how writers can use social media to their best advantage. So stick around. We'll get to that coming right up.
It's the Word Slinger podcast, where story matters. Build your brand, write your book, redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours? Now, here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
Well, I am Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger. I am so glad that you decided to spend another week with me and my really entertaining guest. I can't wait till you get to this interview. It is, by the way, Good Friday, so God bless each of you. I don't know what your particular flavor of spirituality is. I'm a Christian, so I want to spread a little bit of Christian joy to you on this Good Friday. It is a big, important day. It's one of the big important days in my faith. So I hope you have a wonderful day. So that said, let's jump into this interview with BJ Mendelson. But before we do that, I have to offer BJ a huge apology because this was actually recorded a year ago today, if I were to look closer to the dates. It was in April last year, and it just got... It kept getting further and further out because of I had all these interviews stacked up ahead of it, and I took that little hiatus around Christmas time. So, BJ, man, I am sorry that this took so long to come around, so we're going to try to make up for it as best we can. So, that said, 1 year ago, whole different scenario. I just moved into this place. I didn't have the same setup. Everything was a little different. You're going to get to see the Word Slinger logo behind me, which is kind of cool, I have to admit. But that same screen now is my monitor. It's in the exact same spot, and I use it as my monitor. So anyway, so BJ, sorry for the delay, but let's don't delay any further. Let's get right to the good stuff about how social media is just complete BS. And stick around afterwards. I'm going to have some pearls of wisdom or something useful, I'm sure. So stick around after the interview, and I'll see you on the other side. Hey, everybody. Thank you for sticking around through that entire intro, which was sure to be filled with wisdom, but probably went on a little too long. But... the good news is that now you get a chance to listen in on my conversation with BJ Mendelson. Now, he's the author of, and we're going to say this once, so for everybody listening, if you got little ones in the car, any family that you don't want to hear swears, we're going to say this once and then get it over with. Ready? He's the author of Social Media is Bullshit. There. You were warned. If you didn't get the kids' ears plugged in time, that's up to you. So, and that's the last time we'll say that. So, BJ, man, I appreciate you being on the show. I'm sorry, I'm giving you a hard time for your
I love it. And I really appreciate you doing that, because I have a niece who's 4 now, and she's at that stage where she's repeating everything.
Yeah.
So I said the word suck, and then she just walked around going, suck, that sucks.
That sucks, like,
oh,
yeah.
Man, oh, no. So I'm glad that you actually do that, because it's, you know, it's no joke. Those kids will repeat everything.
They will repeat stuff, man. And I can turn the air blue every now and then, ask my wife. But I try not to do that on this show, just because I do know that people sometimes listen to this stuff with their family. And I try to make everything very positive and uplifting, and
which is great.
Yeah. All right. So, the title of your book is an intriguing. We'll just say BS from now on. But I mean, the title of your book is intriguing because, you know, I've had some guests on the show who've talked about social media. On Draft to Digital, I've had some posts about authors and social media, and it's kind of a mixed bag, man. Right. Some folks are all for it, some folks are against it, some folks are kind of eh. What you took a strong position, and I'm sure you there's a twist in there somewhere. So what's behind social media being BS in your eyes?
Well, it's really something more to do with all marketing books than it is related to social media. It's that context matters.
Right.
And context changes for everybody. So in my case, if I'm selling a book that is, let's use a privacy book, for example, I know that that audience really uses the internet. You know, they use forums, they use social media, they're all over the place. So targeting them through those means makes a lot of sense for that book.
Yeah.
With other books, though, if your book is in stores, I found that if you really want to drive sales, social media really doesn't have that much of an impact. It's going to the store, it's doing, you know, book events and appearing on the local radio and doing local press. That's how, with social media's BS, we sold 28 copies through Twitter, and I have like 700,000 followers, whereas we sold over 7,000 copies by virtue of me going out there. Yeah. And actually meeting people and doing radio and doing the local press. So that's really what the book is about, where these tools can be great, but it really depends on how you're going to use them, why you're using them in the first place. Because for a long time, people just dump money into social just to do it. I mean, you still see that today with Facebook ads. Yeah. And the book is saying, don't do that until you've carefully evaluated all your options.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Know your audience. That's a, right. That's a big one. And I think, and that's, and I don't want to drag down anybody who is, for example, sure. using social media for advertising, Facebook in particular. Facebook's big with the author crowd.
Yeah.
Now me, I haven't had as much success with Facebook ads, but then I find them at times incomprehensible.
right. But, deliberately so.
Deliberately so. Right. And I don't want anyone to be discouraged from doing that.
That's right. We
have friends who run courses around that and all and everything.
And
go ahead. Right.
And so, no, I should say, you know, the book, if you look at the back of the book, it says, I'm not talking about the tools. I'm talking about the myth and attitude surrounding the tools, because at the time the book was written, it was like the gold rush. You know, everyone was telling you to get on social.
Right.
And today, now, you know, in 2018, we're a little more realistic about it. So there is nothing wrong with selling courses that teach you Facebook ads. That's totally fine. But my argument is it depends on what you're selling. So with the privacy book, because it's not in stores, I knew that I would have to target an audience that was more internet friendly. So my entire outreach has been podcast, because podcast listeners are more likely to go, oh, okay, I could go to Amazon, buy it right now, and off I go. Whereas if I were to do the show on the radio, people would go into stores to look for it and they wouldn't find it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've brought up the book, and I forgot to actually mention at the head of the show, because we're so focused on not using swears that I didn't mention the other book, the real point that of why you're on the show right now. You're releasing Privacy and How We Get It Back.
Yes.
How We Get It Back. Which, by the way, that's a hot topic right now. And of course, you know that because you wrote a book on the subject. But it's interesting because I just read How to Disappear.
Yes, and that's a great book.
Yes, and he focuses a lot on removing your footprint online. So, but let's talk a little about your book. Sure. Privacy is a big thing. Facebook's big announcements, the big thing going on with Facebook right now, it has brought privacy back into the spotlight. So how does this tie in? Like, how do we get our privacy back?
We get paid for it. That's the short answer. Honestly, like the takeaway for the book is this: there's no consequences right now if you're Facebook for something like Cambridge Analytica. You know, there was a FTC decree that they signed back in 2011 saying if something like this happened again, you would have to pay a fine. And of course, they went and they completely ignored that. So in the States, stuff like this, as long as there's no teeth to the legislation that exists, it's just going to keep happening. So you see that with the data breaches too. You know, there was a SunTrust Bank, I think, was in the news.
Right.
TaskRabbit was in the news just recently for these wide-scale security breaches. Yahoo was actually fined, which is kind of great, this past week for $35 million for their role in a data breach. But that's a rare example. So the first part is that there's no teeth to it. The second part is that you are contributing invaluable data to these platforms. And this data is always packaged and sold. It represents 19% of America's gross domestic product, the advertising industry. And most of that these days revolves around Facebook and Google and your data.
Right.
So my argument is, if you get cut in on that, it'll make the companies think twice. about selling your data. Because right now how it works is I can collect an entire profile on you and know everything there is to know about you and sell that, but you get nothing from that exchange, or you get free Facebook.
Right.
So my attitude is, all right, well, if they cut me in, they have to stop and go, what's the economics behind this? And I found that if you introduce those penalties, they're less likely to be creepy, for lack of a better description.
Right. Yeah. I like that your answer, by the way, was get paid, because you're saying we need to hold them to the fire, right?
Yes. I mean, absolutely.
As the public, we need to actually, put thumb screws in these guys. But how do we do that? Because I know there are class action suits and things like that could happen. I don't know of any specifically, and that's the problem, right? I don't know of any, and I don't know what my involvement could be in one. So how does someone learn about that and participate in those?
Sure. I think the big takeaway from the book on that front is local and state action, not federal action. So contact state general office. In my case, we have Eric Schneiderman, who has been pushing a data privacy bill of rights for some time. So we have places like that. You have places like Seattle where they actually have an office dedicated to data privacy. And so talking to those offices and saying, what's going on? How can I get involved? I think if there's going to be any sort of change, we've seen this throughout the history of the country, it's always going to come locally first, because the federal government has always acted in increments. You know, we don't get widespread change. We get change when the government is shoved. So that's a long way of answering that. And it sounds simple, right? Like, it sounds easier said than done, but it really is true. It's just getting organized on the local level and pushing for citywide, statewide legislation saying, if you are the victim of a data breach, you should be compensated financially and the company should be fined.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So reach out to our local government, reach out to legislators and congressmen and that sort of thing. Yeah. They will pay attention. I know this from years past and stuff I've done. I got involved with the whole thing with the corporal punishment debate and all that years ago. They will listen to that. They will respond to that. And unless they hear from their constituency, they won't really do anything, right?
I mean, I had a group of voters representing about 10,000 people approach me to run for Congress. So if I can make that happen, there's no reason why anyone listening to this couldn't get organized and have people run for Congress or contact their congressman or state representative. It's just, you just have to do it. And I think that's what the problem is that people just don't want to do it. They kind of want to complain about it online and then just drop the issue. I'm saying you have to get out there and actually do the work.
Right. Are you going to run for Congress?
No. That was so if you read the privacy book, and people can find it at yourprivacybook.com, I'm very open about my life and my preferences and whatnot. And so I feel like if I were to run for Congress, there's not too many people that would run out the door to back me unless they're incredibly liberal. So I think I'm a very specific taste to a very specific group of people. So I don't think I'd get that consensus.
Yeah. And I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I'm the conservative guy. So I've had people approach me though. Like I had the Libertarian Party approach me about running for office. And that's intriguing. That actually is intriguing. But anyway, that's a whole different.
but the point is the same, it's just doing it, right? It's just taking that next step and actually putting the work in. It's the same deal of authors selling books. You got to put the work in, and for a long time, you might not see the results, but you got to keep doing it.
Yeah. So maybe I can bring this around for authors specifically. The privacy book is aimed at the general user, but is there anything in there specifically that might benefit authors in the way they think? And I know we hit a little bit on that with like Facebook ads and that sort of thing. So
I think
an avenue there.
The big thing is the economics of the internet. The takeaway of me saying you should get paid for your data is more than just Facebook cutting you a check for like $300 a year or whatever it is. The takeaway is we have these tools that are coming out, like the basic attention token, where authors could get paid by people visiting their site. So there's things like that that are in the works. And that's really what I talk about in the book, is saying the model right now sucks. I shouldn't say that. Stinks. How's that? The model right now stinks, because I know my niece will listen to this. Yeah. And the takeaway is you should learn about things like Bat and the Brave browser, because they're tools that are available right now. If you go to brave.com, you can see the Brave browser, which integrates micropayments. So if you're an author and you're just putting out, like I just yesterday put out a short story for free. So if you go to bjmendelson.com through the Brave browser, you could tip me through a micropayment and I could be compensated that way for my work. And so the way to put a bow on this is that there are other ways to get paid if you're a creator, because right now it's very difficult to make a living. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we start examining and talking about that now so that we can get everything in place to make it work.
It's interesting. And I'm glad you brought up Brave, because I literally only just discovered Brave yesterday on the Phil DeFranco show on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
Because there's a whole thing going on there with demonetization and everything, and Brave reached out to him to sponsor
the
show. Now, and so I wouldn't have been digging in on this. So I'm going to include a link to this in the show notes of this episode. But I love the idea of this. This is trending towards something that I think is on the horizon for authors, which is a more complete ownership of our IP, more direct sales rather than having to rely on Amazon and others. I think we're on the verge of that. Do you see that tying in? I mean, it's, you know, man, we could be all over the place with your topic, by the way. And I don't want to dilute anything.
Oh no, it's all good. We could go anywhere. I mean, that's for me. The thing I wanted to point out about the book is that when we talk about Brave, a lot of people get lost. So like, it's sort of like when you talk to people about Tor, right? They understand the idea behind Tor, but then using it is not a great experience. So the book was designed such a way to just simplify everything and say, this is how this would work. This is how the cryptocurrency would work. Right. So I think just having that discussion is important. Like just talking about getting paid through micropayment and an author hearing that for the first time and then researching it, it's incredibly powerful because it's still at such an early stage that you and I may know about it, but not everyone knows about it.
So right.
I'm definitely taking more of an early advocacy approach at the moment.
Yeah, no. It's interesting because this is right on the heels of Ally announcing that they're embracing blockchain and cryptocurrency as a means of, well, for several reasons. One, to protect against piracy, but also to put the power of IP ownership directly in the hands of the authors. So this all ties in. It's intriguing stuff, but it makes me dizzy.
Right. That's the problem. I mean,
that is the problem.
So I do some advising work on the side, not as much as I used to. And so being in that space, there's definitely this problem with the crypto side of things where they're not communicating to people why this matters. Instead, right now, you sort of get blockchain and everyone gets crazy about it. But you don't. Most people don't know what it is. And so I think over the next few years, we'll finally see people explain, oh, no, if you're an author, this is why this matters. Like you can actually track everything and not, as you mentioned, not use Amazon to do your sales, which is a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. I think one of the problems, frankly, is that when the world at large was introduced to the idea of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, all that, it was handed over as if it was a get-rich-quick scheme.
Yeah.
Like if you invest in Bitcoin, you know, you can make $20,000 in a day because of the, you know, its value rises or whatever. And so it gets framed that way. And I think the importance of it gets lost because it is a way to own more of what we're selling. It's actually much more, I compared it to, in terms of books, it would be much more like being able to sell a physical copy of your book with the sort of control you get over that. Because like I can't buy your book and have it in my hand and read it and then duplicate it and sell it to someone else or give it away. I lose it when it goes away. So there's that aspect of it. But that's my limited understanding, by the way.
No, that's exactly it. But it's the problem is that that's all we're all at that level.
Yeah.
Right. Hang on one second. I'm gonna let the cat out.
Okay.
there's a bunch of them, and he wants to go back.
It's a warts and all show, man.
Yeah, no, they have made their presence known on every interview that I've done. Like they jump in front of the camera, and it's fun. But tying it all back to social media, I mean, back in 2008, it was sort of the same deal, right? Mm-hmm. You know, had Ashton Kutcher on CNN saying Twitter gives you a voice equal to a broadcast network, and you had Gary Vaynerchuk and all of the social media marketers saying you got to get in now and cash in while this thing is big. So right. It's sort of the same deal right now with Bitcoin and blockchain, where there's a lot of hysteria around it, but no one talking about the nuts and bolts of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I have zero interest in the sort of explosive growth idea, jump in now and take advantage of this gold rush. I have no interest in that.
Sure.
I'm only interested in the long-term growth stuff, the stable stuff. So that's where I think your book comes in, in terms of understanding at least the privacy angle, sure. And how that benefits us. I want to dip back into social media for a bit.
Sure.
And I do want people to pick up both of your books. I'm interested, by the way, you're with St. Martin's Press, right?
Yes.
That was, so you're not indie, but.
Well, the privacy book is indie.
Oh, okay.
Privacy book. It was put out by a publisher in the United Kingdom. It was too short.
Yeah.
For St. Martin's to put out, so I went with a publisher in the UK.
I'm really just teasing you, man.
No, it's all right. I think it's. But that's we talk about blockchain and just the future for authors. I think the hybrid of what I'm doing is going to be incredibly common, where you might have a book from St. Martin's and you might have a book from
various
reads, yeah. And I have a comic book that I put out myself. That's entirely self-published.
Really? Tell me about the comic book. I want to hear about
the comic. The comic book is called Vengeance Nevada. It's out on comixology.com. Oh. So I'm still beholden to the Amazon empire.
Yes, you're still in the Amazon, but I know this comic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It found people really liked it so far, yeah. Surprisingly, because I put it out there thinking, okay, I have no idea what's going to happen. Let's just see, which is not what you should do as an author. Like, you should have some kind of plan.
Yeah.
But I found with the comic, I just didn't know. I just didn't know enough about the industry to see what would happen. So, but that hybrid approach, I think, will be common. Like, the next book I'm pitching is called Don't Be Evil, a short guide to being a successful human. And that's a book. That's an old school book proposal that's going to the publishers and that whole song and dance. So I think that's the way to be these days. It's just, it doesn't matter where the book comes out, just get it out there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I've talked about this. I've talked about this at conferences and on panels and things. And the hybrid model is evolving. And I can't help but think that this is what we're going to see in the next. I used to say 10 years and then 5 years, but I think it's more like in the next 2 to 3 years,
we
see a hybrid model take over the industry.
I think it's
sounds like that's what you're doing.
I really think it's here. I think that, let me put it to you this way, like with the privacy book, because it doesn't have the St. Martin stamp on it, it's a lot harder to promote. Mm-hmm. No, it's a lot harder. Like, I had a lot of luck with TV appearances with social media's bullshit, social media's BS, where people were like, oh, okay, let's have you on. Whereas with the privacy book, because it's by this publisher in the United Kingdom that nobody really knows, they're like, I don't know. So, but the fact that I'm still able to sell it and that it's still performing very well and I was able to put out the book on Audible by myself, the fact that you can still do all that today is fantastic.
Yeah,
and there's no barrier. Like, it's not like 10 years ago where everyone was running around saying there was no barrier, whereas now in 2018, no, there really is no
barrier. There really is no barrier, right? Yeah,
so I think we're here.
If you want to hit traditional sales channels, you've got all the tools necessary to do. You can go direct, or you can do guys, Draft to Digital. You could go Draft to Digital, or there are others I hear. But what I'm really loving is that the trend seems to be, the tools seem to be aiming at full ownership, direct right. sale to the customer. And I think we're still kind of in the infancy of that, and I don't know how we make the leap, because, of course, there's still discoverability, and discoverability is always the problem, right? And that's where most people were going to turn to social media. So that brings us back around, because I'm curious, like, what is the most effective way to use social media for this?
Again, it depends on the audience. For the comic, for example, the comic is the best social media use case that I have. So I had trouble selling social media as BS through Twitter. I sold 28 copies, whereas I sold over 6,000 by doing the offline stuff. With the comic, because it's entirely on Comixology, it's not in stores, you really don't have much of a choice but to use social media.
Right.
And so for that specific use case, I am very active within the comics community, because the comics community has embraced Twitter. So it really, again, it really depends on who is the audience. Do they use these platforms in the first place?
What
other channels do you have? And in the case of a comic book where you don't really have a lot of channels, you kind of have to go and use social media. So just the fact that we're talking about this and having a discussion, I think, is powerful, because 10 years ago, you know, when the book came out in 2012, we were not having that conversation. The conversation was, you have to be on Facebook, you have to be on Twitter, you have to be on LinkedIn, you have to be posting around the clock to get traction. Whereas today it's sort of like, all right, well, let's take a step back and look and see what the specific use case is for that specific audience and book.
Yeah. And how does one determine that Twitter is the environment for their specific product?
Lots of research. I don't want that to sound complicated or hard. It's just a lot of watching.
Yeah.
So for example, there's a lot of indie authors who double as comics creators.
Right.
And so I just did a lot of research on them and who they interacted with and what hashtags they were using. And I was looking at the amount of interaction, because that's, you know, we haven't talked about the algorithms at all, but the amount of interaction you have as soon as you post something is really important. And so if you see a lot of activity among a certain crowd, like the comics crowd, then it says, okay, well, if I post something on this platform, then I have good luck of this stuff being displayed.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, again, if you don't have the interaction, your posts drop like a rock.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, and then there's gotta be some conclusion we can draw here. But once again, with social media, it comes back to the cost is someone's attention.
That's right.
Usually always your attention, you know, but it's always someone's attention, right?
And I found that if you have, so the trick to social media is that you want to make sure you have other things in place. Like you want to have a website, you want to have some kind of credibility before you start to use social media. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't, then you're just part of like that group of spammers who's like, hey, check out my album. Hey, check out my book. Hey, check out my comic.
Right.
You have no idea who they are. I mean, I get that a lot for Kickstarter. Yeah. A lot of comics creators are constantly like, hey, can you promote this thing on Kickstarter? I have no idea who this person is.
Right.
So there's something to be said about offline credibility first before you do go ahead with these social platforms.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you got to spend the time building. And that's what, when we say building your platform, that's really part of what we mean is spend the time to build the foundation so that when you have, when you carve that path, it leads somewhere.
That's right. And there is one exception though. Like if you find yourself with extra cash burning a hole in your wallet,
then
Facebook ads, if done properly, could be very valuable. We've seen time and time again that social media benefits, you know, the rich get richer with social media. So if you do have money, then that is a good channel to use. Whereas I'd like to think that most indie authors are kind of like me, where you're trying to spend as little as you can to promote the book and make as much as you can.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Because I talk to a lot of folks who depend on social media, let's just say specifically Facebook ads. Sure. Facebook ads and Amazon ads are big right now, but Facebook ads are the one that are open to everybody. The key really is to have the kind of budget where you're essentially throwing money at this, right? So in that case, the ads themselves are not a good investment for the author who isn't already doing pretty well. So it's not going to get you to the level, to that, you know, financial level that you're trying to hit. But if you put in the groundwork and you build up to the point where you can start throwing money at Facebook ads, it takes you to a whole different level, which is the thing I think that most authors struggle with, because they want the magic bullet and Facebook ads look like a magic bullet sometimes.
Well, I think the big problem is we all want it now.
Yeah.
I think if I use Facebook, then I'm going to get all these results right now. And the thing I've always tried to tell other authors is this takes time. And each book, I feel like you start from zero. So no matter what you had with, no matter what I had with social media is BS, with the privacy book, I'm starting from scratch, you know? And so it's important to get all those things in place and then looking at all of your options. And so it takes time and people don't appreciate that. They just think, I'll get it overnight, and that's not at all how
it's not. It's not been my experience. I haven't overnighted success in like 20 years. So, but one thing to consider though is that you now that you have the second book, this is going to be a little tricky because I don't want to mislead anybody. But you can start to focus your marketing efforts on that second book
and sort of curtail some of your marketing efforts on the first book, because you can literally use the second book as a marketing tool for the first book.
Yes.
So that's where you can kind of start stacking a little.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something that I recently discovered on my own, is I really didn't anticipate there being like this boomerang effect where if people bought the privacy book, they would turn around and buy social media's BS or vice versa. Right. But it is true that, it's not true with the, so again, it depends on the audience, right? So I'll give you an example. The people who buy my comics, I've noticed all buy a book as soon as they're done reading the comic. They have all converted to reading the privacy book. Yeah. Whereas the privacy people have not converted to the comic.
Yeah.
But they have converted to social media's BS. But there is definitely that chain that forms of these different products coming together.
That's interesting. Well, because as a comic reader myself, like I love comics, and I also have a wide interest, very eclectic reading interest, right? And I would read these two books, and will read these two books. I promise you. Here I am. but again, folks, everybody always criticizes me. Why don't you read the guy's books before they come on air? It's because they contact me like the week before.
Right, and it's also in your defense, like I have not. Maybe out of the hundreds of interviews that I've done, maybe two people have actually read the book. Mm-hmm. So it's not common that you come onto any show.
If I were Oprah Winfrey, I would have read the book and taken copious notes.
That's right.
And highlighted passages so that I could quote them back to you. On page 197,
that's the burden of being a billionaire, right?
Yes. Well, man, there must be a lesson to learn from that, brother. Yeah. If that's the burden of being a billionaire with a B, I need to start reading some damn books before you people get on the show. I don't even know where I was going, man. Now I'm just taking life lessons. I think I had what Oprah refers to as an aha moment just now.
That's great.
So now speaking of marketing, how are you using social media to market these books right now?
So I am using social media to contact people I can't reach through email.
Okay.
So that's, in America, this is specific to the American audience. So most journalists in the United States have a Twitter account.
Right.
Like it's about 80%, 85% penetration. And so if you are looking to contact a journalist, Twitter for that specific context is very good. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I'm using it for the privacy book. I'm reaching out to podcasters and I'm reaching out to journalists through Twitter and saying, okay. Hey, I've got this new book. Can we talk? Can I send you a free copy? So,
and because you came to me through my site.
That's right.
Did you find me first on Twitter and then
no,
or Facebook or something?
I highly recommend. So I've known about your show through other authors.
Okay.
And I've seen it come up in Facebook groups. That's a good example of social media is useful when it's about community and people.
Yeah.
And not so good when it comes to promotion without all this other stuff that we've talked about.
Right.
So that's how I knew about your show. But with other shows, there is a tool called BuzzSumo, which I typed in the word podcast. And it generated a list of about 10,000 podcasters on Twitter. Now, most of that list are people that aren't active anymore or had a podcast like years ago. Mm-hmm. But I'd say at least 60% of it are active podcasters. And so I've just sat down and said, okay, if the book is not in stores, doing radio is probably not the most effective thing I can do with my time, but doing the podcast is, because that audience is more likely to go, oh, I'll click on the link and buy a book. And so I went down that entire list of the 10,000 and contacted everybody.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So that tool was very useful. And again,
I'm very excited that I'm included on a list of 10,000 other podcasters.
it's more like let's say 7,000, because I had to delete 3,000 for not being active.
I know that is trouble. And of course, I go on a ton of shows, to promote me, to promote
Traffic
Digital. You have to. And really, here's what's interesting about podcasts. I know we're veering off a little, but what's interesting about podcasts is this really is a space where authors gravitate. And I'm not entirely sure why, but if your goal is to reach authors, the podcast space is it. And
so there's two arguments for that, right? Like the first is that if you're an author and you do, I've done a lot of cable TV appearances.
Yeah.
You only have like 3 minutes.
Right.
To say anything. And most of those 3 minutes are going to be dominated by the other hosts interrupting you and asking questions. So you really don't have much time to talk. Whereas with podcasts, we can have a 30-minute, 45-minute conversation. So that's the first thing. The second thing, NPR found that most podcast listeners tend to be better educated and have a higher income. So whether or not
that's... Hear that, everybody. You're better educated.
And have a higher income. And I'm sure you're all very good looking.
Very good looking.
We have a handsome and beautiful audience. So please buy the book. See, you could do that at TV. Like, you couldn't just stop it and slide that in. So,
right.
Statistically, the podcast listeners tend to be book readers is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Sorry. I was taking a sip of coffee right as you finished. Yes. And then, that's not entirely non sequitur, by the way, for whatever reason, I don't know why this is possibly just in my head. I've always lumped, podcasts in with social media.
Sure.
I know they're not social media. They don't fit the definition. But for some reason there's a connection there in my brain. So,
increasingly you can make that argument though, cause there's stuff like Anchor.
Yes, that's true. Periscope.
Let you do that interactive podcast. So I think increasingly you're seeing everything kind of merge together.
That's a very good point, man.
And that's true of SMS. Mm-hmm. Like all of the thing I said in social media is BS is that the way we think about these platforms is wrong. You know, we've allowed like the ad industry to kind of shape how we approach these platforms, but it's always changing. And so Anchor is a good example in 2018 of podcasts becoming social media.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. I'm going to make a note here. it's hard for me to slip that in. I try to do it when you're still talking, and then you're real good about it. You're very succinct.
I came from radio.
Most of my, yes. Okay. So we both have radio backgrounds. That explains it. okay. No, but that's a very good point. And I'm sorry about that, everybody. more and more, I mean, specifically, I was thinking YouTube. YouTube is very much a social media platform in which instead of posting something I wrote, I'm posting something I produced ahead of time. Facebook Live I think it's Facebook Live, right? Their video component, same thing, except it is a live stream, and I interact with people. I haven't done that in a while. I'm sorry, everybody, but that's fairly cool. Now, again, these tools, you would need to find out whether or not your specific audience resonates with these tools before you invest a lot of time, money, and effort in trying to promote your work through there.
I have a good trick for that.
Good. That's what I was about to ask you. Yeah.
So write a letter to your ideal customer.
Okay.
And I think that helps because you can't say everybody, right? Like you can't just walk around and be like, everybody's my audience, because that's just not...
It's the Ford principle, right?
Right. Well,
if everyone's your customer, no one's your customer.
Exactly. And so it works for Ford, right? Because Ford reaches everybody. Whereas there's so much competition between authors and publishers and everything, where I think you have to be very specific as to who you're selling the book to, and writing a letter to your ideal customer. That's not an original idea. That's an old thing that's popped up over the years.
Right.
But I found that to be an effective tactic.
I think for authors, they may be familiar with that advice in that we're told to do something similar to find our ideal reader.
Right.
Here's what's interesting, and there is a distinction. I believe this, that there is a distinction between your ideal reader and your ideal customer of a book.
Yes.
Because you would reach the two, and your ideal reader may not be reachable on social media or through any of the channels accessible to you, which is sad. But enough of them may also be ideal customers.
That's right. And so it all comes down to word of mouth.
Yes.
Honestly, I feel like word of mouth sort of got lost in the shuffle over the years, where people were attracted to things like social media, which is partly word of mouth, but not entirely. So you're right. You might find that your ideal reader is not your ideal customer, but if there's enough overlap, whereas you do have a few ideal customers that become readers, they will do the marketing for you.
Yeah.
And then that in turn will help you reach the other people that you were trying to reach in the first place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right now I've been performing a little experiment over the past, it's been extended. I was going to do it for 30 days and it's been about 3 months now.
Oh, cool.
Where my entire marketing is 100% dependent on word of mouth. And I have seen huge, huge results from that. Maybe not as big as if I had dumped $30,000 into a Facebook ad campaign, but it's remarkable in that theoretically, according to some folks I've talked to, you shouldn't have any traction at all. It's like not marketing. Right. It's the easiest kind of marketing I've ever done. So I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, it's highly effective. I recommend people. There's a lot of great books out there about it. But it can be encapsulated into this. Is your product so easy and simple that your grandmother and grandfather can understand and share it with other people?
Yeah.
And if the answer is yes, then you've got a product that will benefit from word of mouth.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. That's great, man. Okay. That sounds like a great way to wrap up. Sure. I want to mention the titles again, sort of. Social Media is BS is the first one. You may spell that out, people. Go ahead. Do what you do in the privacy of your own web browser is up to you. And then privacy and how we get it back. Something I'm very interested in with everything that's going on in the world right now. I think this is a very topical book. You can pick up both of those, of course. I'm guessing anywhere ebooks are sold, anywhere books are sold, right?
That's right. You can find the privacy book at yourprivacybook.com, but it's also on Audible and Amazon.
Okay. And then, of course, tell people where they can find you and your body of work online.
Sure. Well, I just keep it very simple. BJMendelson.com is the place to find me. And I also give out my cell phone number. And I do this because, you know, we didn't touch on it too much, but when you tweet something, not everyone sees it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if someone texts me, I see everything. Like, you get every text. And so my phone number is 646-331-8341. That's 646-331-8341. If you text me the word Sheetrock, I will send you a free PDF copy of Social Media is BS. And Sheetrock is spelled exactly as it sounds. And that's honestly the best way to keep in touch. I mean, unless you're really into pro wrestling and comic books, you can follow me on Twitter. That's what I use Twitter for. But BJMendelson.com or at the phone number with a text. And that's the way to keep in touch.
I'm going to follow you on Twitter because I like what you have to say. And I want to subscribe to your newsletter. look, I just followed you. There you go. And I see your cat in your profile picture. Yep.
There's one of five.
Oh, look. I clicked follow and a whole bunch of balloons popped up. That means something. I don't know what that means.
Oh, it's a birthday. It's a birthday thing.
Is it your birthday today?
It is.
Today's my happy birthday, man. You took time out of your birthday to talk to me.
I did.
Well, happy birthday to me. I got the present. All right. Well, okay, everybody, you're going to find links to all that stuff in the show notes, of course. Please, if you're driving, pull aside to enjoy your BJ Mendelson. That's pretty much it. I'll put the phone number and the password in the show notes as well for people to download, to get a copy of the PDF copy of Social Media is BS. I have my copy and I will start reading that probably very soon. So thank you for that. All right, everybody. Thank you, BJ, for being on the show, man. I appreciate you coming on.
Yep, thank you.
Everybody else, you're probably hearing the groovy bridge music right now. You may dance in place at will. Stick around for industry news and other cool stuff after this break, and I'll see you all next time.
Hear your book the way it was meant to be heard. With a fully custom soundtrack based on your material. An album of music that perfectly fits your characters, your settings. Hear your book today. SonataInscribe.com.
Hey, thanks for sticking around. I hope you enjoyed that interview with BJ Mendelson. I know I did. I still feel bad that it took a year for this to air. But there was a lot of wisdom in that interview and in the way that BJ says we should focus on and use social media. So something that is really, that's kind of resonating with me lately. Honestly, I've taken a hiatus from certain social media. I still have to participate in social media, but I think BJ's right, man. It's complete BS. I've kind of walked on Facebook, at least on the personal side, and I'm feeling a lot better actually since sort of turning Facebook off. I still do things. I still post things. I don't check it. I don't get involved in conversations. I don't even scan the news feed anymore. It's just not, it was kind of tearing me down, honestly. I was feeling a little overwhelmed by it. I was always anxious and angry. The divisiveness that's that's taken hold in our culture. I think it has its roots in social media. I mean, when you're on social media, that's what you see most of the time is people being bitter, people being angry and hateful. So I just decided that there are some amazingly good people on social media. I do want to figure out a way to circle back around and keep up with them. But I'm imposing a filter. I'm imposing a personal filter on my social media use. And I do stuff that's tied to my work, you know, helps me to promote my work. But it, I do want interaction with people, so I'll have to figure it out. So if you've got some tips and advice on that, feel free to let me know. Go over to wordslingerpodcast.com. Find this episode's episode number 177. And you can leave a comment on the show notes. Tell me how you're managing social media and what you're, how you deal with it. I can always use the help. What's funny though, and this ties into today's topic, the little fireside chat that we have now after the interview. So, you know, I've been working on a lot of things in my life and career. Making some changes, developing some new habits. Some of those habits are revolve around my health. Some revolve around my writing career. Some revolve around sort of my aspirations for a sort of bigger world, a bigger empire of sorts. And a lot are tied to relationships and just my personal well-being. So in all that, I've been doing a lot of reading, studying, putting into practice a lot of the things that I'm learning. And one of the things that's been incredibly helpful, this is actually something I've done most of my life, but not as consistently as I probably should have. But one of the tools I talk about in 30 Day Author, for example, is journaling. Now, in 30 Day, I'm talking about it as a way to improve your craft. But I also mention how, you know, this sort of thing is really kind of just good for your spiritual and mental health, we'll say. It helps you, it gives you a place to put your ideas. It gives you a place to put, you know, the things that are bothering you so that you can deal with them on the page rather than deal with them out in the physical world. So journaling is something I think is very useful. And I always admonish people to treat every form of writing. Anytime you're writing anything, treat it as practice. So if you're writing a text message or you're writing in a journal, if you're writing an article or a blog post, if you're writing an email, everything should be, you should try to do the very best job you can do with that writing. Make that practice. Write the way, write in your voice, write with proper grammar, proper spelling. Make sure that what you're doing is helping you to build and grow in this area that you're interested in this area that you consider part of your work. I'm sorry, I'm all fidgety. I'm kind of a little uncomfortable in my own skin right now for some reason. But I have been journaling. I keep looking. You keep seeing me look over here. I've got a couple of my journals sitting here. So, like right now, I've got these two are journals, and each has a sort of purpose. Now, this one's my Moleskine. I've always got a Moleskine. These are my favorite little notebooks. They have some history to them. You can see I've done quite a bit of writing in this. And what I've started doing with this one more than anything is it's helped me kind of figure out, like, for example, I'll write a question at the top of a page. And then I'll sort of free write just some answers that come to me about that question. Or sometimes I'll do things like today I said, how can today be a good day? What does a good today look like? And I wrote down like six different random things that popped into my head. You know, yesterday's was, how do I reframe instantly so I can shift negative to positive? So that sounds, I know that to some that's going to sound a little odd, but it is sort of a way for me to access my subconscious. And get answers from deep within, we'll say. So that's what I'm using this for. I also use this to jot down. I've got a couple pages in here of jokes. Because I kind of like the idea. I following some of the comedians that I follow, like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, they keep notebooks of jokes. So I've jotted a few ideas down just to try it out, you know, play around with it. But that's what this space is for. It's for playing around with your ideas so that you can track them, keep track of them, and also expand on them later if you want. This journal is, and if you're not watching this on YouTube, I apologize. You're just getting a blow-by-blow. But this journal is similar in that this one's a focused journal. This one is it's meant for a purpose. I have something I'm building called Written World, and it is kind of my overarching empire, we'll say. It's going to be the parent of everything else that I do, branching off of my writing and publishing, you know, as a start. And this book is about, or this journal is about, exploring all what Written World is, what its personality is, what its purpose is, how, you know, when I have employees, how do I treat the employees? What do they get for being part of Written World? I jotted down that, you know, on the topic of employees, actually, I jotted down that we are about empowering employees. And so what does that mean? You know, how do you empower an employee? I'm making notes about what I'm calling Written World Outreach, which is the charitable side of my business. I've decided it's going to be a hybrid charity, a for-profit charity, which I know may sound odd to some folks, but look that up on YouTube. There is a TED Talk that you might want to check out about how for-profit charities can be more impactful to the people they're trying to help. For a variety of really good reasons. So as I learn things and I say, that's a good idea, I'd like to implement that into a business, it goes into this Written World journal. And this is what I'm mining to build a business plan, a plan of action, to build the business out in stages, right? I have, the typical 1 year, 5 year, 10 year idea. What does the business look like a year from now? What does it look like 5 years from now? And, you know, the important thing about this kind of stuff is you write this down, but you need to take action, right? So just like being a novelist, just like being a writer of any kind, nonfiction or fiction, you can outline all you want, but until you actually sit down to write the book, you're not a writer. You gotta actually write the book. So what's the adage that writers write and authors have written? You can't be an author until you have written. You can't be a writer unless you write. So you can't be in business unless you take action and start the business. So I'm planning now, but I'm also taking some actions based on the things that go into these journals. Journaling is a way for you to explore. I have multiple journals. I got a whole stack of journals over here. I have a journal app that I like to use called Day One. For a long time, I was actually using using Scrivener for journaling, and you can still do that. But I found an app called Day One. Now they've since moved to a subscription model, a SaaS model. Software as service is what SaaS stands for. One moment. Refreshing water. They have moved to a paid model, which I abhor. if you've known me for any length of time, it's kind of the death knell for any application I use when it decides it's switching to a pay for use model. I don't begrudge the designers of these applications for trying something that, you know, is supposed to help them and make them profitable. That's what a business is for. I do begrudge the fact that I slowly bleed money into the things that I use in my daily life on such a regular basis that it becomes overwhelming. And while I can afford it, I hate it. I hate that, you know, everything wants to take a nickel and dime from me at every turn. So I've got a grandfathered version of this app, which I think may still be available to download. It's, I guess, unsupported, meaning if there's technical glitches or if the operating system evolves past its capabilities, they won't support it. So far, that hasn't been a problem. And if it ever happens, I guess I'll have to figure out a way to export everything into a new journal. But anyway, that should be neither here nor there. I get irritated at the software as a service model sometimes when it's every single app, every single piece of software I own becomes SaaS. You may have a different opinion of that, and maybe I should reconsider that. But it does kind of get a little overwhelming, especially when these things are generally like, $5 to $10 a month, that $10 a month, if I just count the number of applications on my desktop right now, I could easily be paying, if I were paying $10 a month for each, I could easily be paying several thousand dollars a month just to operate this computer I own. So, why am I paying so much money for a computer if I'm going to have to pay thousands more just to use it? All right, I digress. All right. So anyway, back to journaling. So I use a digital journal. That's more of my sort of personal journal. What I like about Day One in particular is that it can actually have several journals. So I've got one that is my personal, dear diary kind of stuff. Another that is sort of aphorisms and future thinking, like I'm writing these journal posts. It's my future journal is what it's called. I write as if I've already accomplished the things that I've done, so that I put myself in that headspace. I have a gratitude journal in there that is, that was my phone, by the way, a gratitude journal that is, where I write down what I'm grateful for. It's pretty self-explanatory. I shouldn't have even hesitated. So anyway, I've got that, and then I've got a bunch of other notebook journals and things like that. And you don't have to write in every single one of these things every day. I think it's pretty good to probably get one or two to play around with it first. And you just use what makes you comfortable. But I think you should, as a writer, keep a journal. And you can do whatever you want with it. Some people, all they do is write down their ideas. Maybe they have a story idea, so they flesh it out on the journal page before they start writing it. Maybe that's where they do their outlining. Some people just keep journals that are just grocery lists, what they did that day, a catalog of what they did that day. Keep a journal for how much exercise you've gotten, how many laps you've run around a track, how many laps you swam in a pool, how much weight you've lifted, how much, what did you eat? People keep food journals, that sort of thing. So these things are very helpful. But for writers, I think they are a free and safe space for people to really kind of dig in on their craft and capabilities, stretch themselves a little, warm themselves up. I do a little bit of journaling in the mornings before I start writing. And it sort of activates that center in my brain that puts me in flow. It makes it a lot easier for me to get into that state of flow. Now, if you don't know what I mean by that, so the state of flow is a flow of streaming consciousness, right? It's that state you get into when you're in the zone. So if you were a runner, when you first start running, you're thinking about the running, you're thinking about your sore muscles, you're thinking about the stress of the day, or you're thinking about the miles ahead. But once you kind of get into the flow of running, then now your thoughts can wander. You can, you're no longer concentrating on your body. You're no longer feeling the exertion. You're feeling energized. You're feeling compelled, and you no longer think about the miles ahead or the miles behind. You're right there. You're present. And if that sounds familiar, it's the same idea as meditation. So I personally think that getting into a state of flow in your work is the same as meditating, especially for writers. There are different types different practices for meditation. And I admit, I'm not really, I haven't put a lot of time and energy into learning to meditate in the traditional sense, sitting in a cross-legged pattern, hands on my knees, breathing rhythmically. Maybe I should do that more. I hear there are a lot of health benefits for that, a lot of psychological benefits for that. I feel like I get that from my work, my hours writing, but you know, I could be wrong. So journaling is a useful tool to help prime the pump, as it were, and so that when you start your writing, you're already warmed up. You know, I mean, it's kind of like doing vocal exercises before you go out on stage and sing, or stretching before you do something, you know, participate in a sport. You get warmed up, and it makes it a little easier to get into a state of flow with your work. So I highly recommend it. And it doesn't matter how you do it. If you prefer doing it digitally, I've got this journal app that I use day one is available on my computer, on my laptop, on my iPad and iPhone. I'm pretty sure it may, there's at least an equivalent on Android phones and Windows. So I can do that anywhere. If I don't have a notebook with me, if I don't have, you know, I always stick this Moleskine goes in my bag when I travel. So I've at least got this guy with me. But if I forgot it, I could do the same thing on my phone. It doesn't matter what the medium is. It only matters that you're making the effort and doing the work. I do also like having a journal dedicated to certain ideas. This journal that's dedicated to written world will go in, you know, an archive of things related to written world. It'll be a part of the history of that project. When I was producing film and TV, I kept a journal for a production we were working on, a series that we were working on, and those notes went in as part of the series. So, you know, if I want to look back at it later and know what I was thinking when we did this interview with a Special Forces officer, or, you know, someone who restored a historic aircraft or whatever, I can know what I was doing that day. I can know what I was thinking that day and what, you know, the impressions I got from the interview, which could help me shape that story later. So that's a useful practice. I wish I had done it more. I mean, I say it like I just was very, you know, on the ball with it. I wasn't as consistent with it as I should have been, and I probably could have gotten a lot more out of it. But imagine doing that. Now I'm going to get into an area that I wish I were a little more diligent about. Sorry that my phone keeps vibrating. But keeping a journal like that while you write a book could be very helpful to you. So at the end of every one of my books is something I call, now I call it a note at the end. I used to call it stuff at the end. It's an afterword. Basically, a little note from me to the reader that gives some insight into what I was thinking when I wrote the book, maybe a little dive into some of the research that I did, you know, a little bit of extra material that isn't part of the novel per se, but is you know, tied to it, is a piece of it. So I keep these little journals. I don't do it as consistently as I should, but maybe I'll commit to that. But I do keep journals of what I'm doing, you know, what I'm thinking, where I found something or whatever that goes into these books. And I do this primarily in day one, and day one allows me to tag each entry. So as I'm writing them, I tag it with the title of the book. So later I just click on that tag and every single entry appears as if by magic. And now half of this thing is written. You know, I can lift pieces wholesale from it. I'm basically writing it as I go. So, and then I just edit and pull it together and make it cohesive. So you can see how this could be very valuable to you. Being able to look back is useful. Being able to put your head in the same headspace so you can maybe you can just pick up. You're doing some editing and you need to know what you were thinking when you wrote this scene. You can go back and look at your notes on that scene and get right back into it. There's all kinds of benefits to this. So that's it. I feel like journaling is a really important and powerful tool for writers. I think it's something we don't utilize as much these days as we should. I know there are people who are just absolutely in love with this. There are a million ways to do journaling. There's no wrong way. What you have to do is experiment and find the method that works for you. Now, I have a structure to my journal entries when they're handwritten, because I like to note certain, we're going to call it metadata. Okay. So when I do it digitally, it's kind of a lot of this stuff is recorded for me. But when I do it on the page, I have to do it by hand, and I almost prefer it because what I put at the top of each entry is that day's date. And I like to write it out, choose your format, but I like to write it all out. I like to write, and I like to put my day in front of my month, right? So it's European style. So, today is 19, or it's actually what I say is Friday, 19 April 2019. So that goes at the top. Below that, I say the time. So it would be 9:03 a.m. And then I put a little dash, and then I write down where I am while I'm writing. So I might say home office, or I might say, Starbucks in Seattle, or maybe I'm going to be in St. Louis in a couple of weeks, so I'll find a place in St. Louis, and that entry will say, "Random Coffee House, St. Louis, such and such hotel, St. Louis," and that way, I've got a record of the date, the time, and the place, and I can instantly put myself right back there when I want to. So if it was a good day, and I feel good about it, and I want to revisit it, now I've got even more detail that I can fall back on. And I keep threatening to digitize all my handwritten journals, but it's quite an undertaking for me because I've got hundreds of these things. I've got just a crate full of old Moleskines from years and years of carrying them around in my pocket and my bag. It really is my go-to portable notebook, and I prefer the one with the grid. If you're wanting to be like Kevin, I prefer the Moleskines. They usually have a yellow label and they have gridded paper. If you can see on YouTube, you can see the grid. It's like graph paper. I prefer that because I can write on that, but I can also, if I decide I want to sketch something or whatever, I can use the grid method to sketch something, or I can whatever. It's more flexible. So you might like blank pages or whatever. That's just how I do it. That's how the Word Slinger does it. So you just have to decide what works for you, what makes you feel comfortable, and what you're going to get the most value out of. But I recommend journaling. It's kind of taken the place of social media for me, honestly. It's where rather than go spew something on social media, which I tried to stop doing anyway, if I feel passionately about something, I put it on the page. And then I can include it in a book, or I can, write a blog post or something, and it's fresh to the world instead of I also don't have to deal with comments. I don't have to deal with people deciding they know what I mean better than I know what I mean, or deciding that I am that I'm an imbecile, or deciding to take anything I say negatively when I actually meant it positively, whatever. And I don't have to worry about any of it because it's right there on my page. I fully own and control. I'm empowered by it. So anyway. Great tool. Speaking of empowerment, is a great tool for personal and professional empowerment. You will only benefit by using journals to shape your skill, your craft, and the way you think. So, and your personality, your career, everything will benefit. All right, that's it. We're going to wrap it up. This has been, a good episode. You're going to have to let me know. I really appreciate you sticking around, listening to these things. I get a lot of great feedback from people who are listening to the show, and God bless you. I appreciate you being here. So take care of yourselves out there. Have a wonderful, this is Good Friday. Easter's coming up, you know, big important day among Christians, but it's also a great day for just remembering to stop and be grateful for your family, for the people you love that are in your life. And you know, the wonderful things that can come to you. So my charge to you before we leave today is go out and find someone and say something kind to them and do something kind for them. And, don't expect anything in return. Just do it because you want to spread a little love. So God bless each of you. I will see all of you in the next episode. Take care. Hey, thanks for tuning in to the Wordslinger Podcast. Now, you can support this show by visiting wordslingerpodcast.com. That's where you're going to find back episodes, books by me, and links to anything and everything Wordslinger. And be sure to subscribe to this show on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and anywhere else fine podcasts are sold. I'm Kevin Tomlinson. Thanks for tuning in. We'll check you next time. Wordslinger.